I'm Gaius, John Bachelor Gematicus. Mark of Laos is here. We're drinking a cup of wine by the Thames. Springtime. The shoppers have largely gone home for supper. We're on to our way to the sacrifice to Augustus, our great god. There's trouble along the Danube. There's always trouble along the Danube, but we don't care to talk about it right now. We're going to trouble along the Rhine. It's the summer of 1932, and I've been reading yet another book about that time, and I began to have this sense that I'm reading a Shakespearean history. All the players are in place. I know what's going to happen. I know the outcome. I know who will win on the battlefield. Macduff will win. Macduff always wins, but still it's a fascination to watch the twisting of the plot. And Germanicus, what I learned from the summer of 32 until the Hitlerites prevail and take over the Reich, and then soon after the Reichstag fire, they suspend all civil rights and Germany is a dictatorship. What I learn is that the moments when history goes wrong are legion. They're everywhere. There's no one moment you could say, if this had happened, then everything would have been okay. That's what I learned again and again when I read this. There's a rush towards a bad outcome, and there's no one can stand in its way. And certainly when you read about it 70 years later, you don't even think anymore, what if? You just follow the villains, you follow the heroes, and then 70 years later you go, what is happening now that 70 years from now they will see that we can't see? We just have a few moments, Germanicus, before we rush to Augustus and then the theater. What is your guess about what we can't see now that they will point to 70 years from now? What is that, the year right towards the end of the 21st century?
What was so acutely in the air, like a giant charge of static electricity ready to crackle and burst into electrical flame, was the Depression and the coming apart of not just the idea of capitalism, but also the idea of the victorious powers in World War I. And so in 1932, the United States, Britain, and France were in bad shape, and they were looking inward, and they could no longer assert the larger authority that they had held all the way until 1930 in the London Naval Conference, for example. That had all kind of evaporated in the unraveling that occurred in the very early 1930s, especially after the collapse of the Austrian Kreditanstalt 1931. And there was really no energy available to deal with the turmoil that was about to tear Germany apart, just as it had torn Germany apart at the end of World War I. So Germany was really potentially on the cusp of a second civil war. And yet the so-called victors of World War I were completely immersed in their domestic squabbles and problems. So for example, Ramsay MacDonald and Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain, the British government was worried more about labor and the possibility of socialism taking over in Britain than they were about Germany. The U.S. was in a total crisis. What is fascinating, though, is that externally, as today, they still behaved as though they were the victors and the ruling parties in the world. They still excluded the Soviet Union, although that would end with Roosevelt's election. They still chided Japan and treated it with some contempt. They did nothing to assist China. The best supporter of China at this time was Germany, believe it or not. And so you had the old rhetoric, or the rhetoric that had attained at the great victory in November 1918 and the Versailles Treaty, and they still held to that, and yet they were being immobilized from within. And I think that is a useful, if not metaphor, then at least a point of departure for talking about what's going on now. Because the nations of Europe and their societies are riven. They're riven deeply and existentially, and we don't have time to go into that, but we don't need to because everyone can see it. And it's even more obvious in the United States. The United States is essentially in a kind of a civil war. And yet the public rhetoric emanating from the imperial court is that the U.S. must, at all costs, maintain its world empire, a world empire that has already collapsed. What we have is a much more shrunken empire, as we've been talking about, with Europe, Japan, Korea, Taiwan. And that empire is at all costs to be maintained. And for the larger American empire to hold sway, even if it means war with China. It already has led us to war with Russia de facto. So the U.S. is in a situation not unlike that of the dominant powers in the early 30s, the so-called liberal democracies, that they were trying to hold on to a world that was rapidly collapsing around them, and they were totally totally mesmerized with the collapsing societies that they were trying to not only keep afloat, but keep command of. And the result was that things came apart fairly quickly. And I think that is where we are today. We talk about an election in November, but it won't be an election as much as it will be a kind of spasmodic clash, a struggle. I mean, indeed, there's a movie about civil war in America opening in the theaters next week. It's like a canary in the coal mine, just as in late antiquity, there were all these literary apocalypses being written, which talked about the end of the world, because in many ways, the world was coming apart during the time that the Western Roman Empire fell, and there were all the barbarian invasions.
So
we're in a period like that now, and so we sense that this is happening, but it's all being covered up by the official rhetoric of the government, which is engaged in policies that will only exacerbate the very coming apart and loss of their power and authority that they fear.
That's the role of the government, of course, Germanicus. How would it happen any other way? They're not historians. So you see, I just want to understand this. 70 years from now, what they will point to is that Franz Joseph couldn't hold the empire together. Is that it? Is that what they'll see? And that we were in denial about how weak we were.
Well, Austria-Hungary was far more advanced because Franz Josef understood he had to do something, and he was about to do something. He was about to make what we call Czechia now, you know, Bohemia and Moravia, an equal to Austria and Hungary. He was about to start taking that empire down the path of confederation, which might have saved that empire. We don't have anyone today in a leadership position in the United States.
I understand. I'm trying to come down to what they will see 70 years from now. They will see that we were trying to hold the empire together, or that we were unaware that the empire was coming apart.
What they'll see is that the leadership ruling class in America was no better, no more elevated, no more worthy of respect than what the French called the ci-devant, meaning the aristocrats of the Ancien Régime right before the French Revolution.
Right, and Papin formed a government of barons. I understand. So we're talking about the denialism in the capitals of empire. That's
we're talking about an unworthy leadership class that has atrophied and lost their ability not only to lead, but to see.
Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. I am Gaius John Batson. We're on to the theater. There are proverbs tonight. I'm certain they're Greek proverbs, something about Oedipus. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.